Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 17th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Hospitals Long Way From Normal by Meg Wingerter. COVID-19, More Rules Fall as CDC Hinting at Better Times by Sarah Burnett. High gas costs from Ukraine threat pose a political risk. And Douglas County, District Will Not Release Names by Jessica Seaman. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Omicron in retreat, but problems remain. Hospitals long way from normal. Workers burned out. Patients who skipped care sicker. Staffing issues a long-term fix. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado's hospitals are expected to get a relative break from COVID-19 over the next few months, but a return to any kind of pre-pandemic normal remains elusive as medical staffers deal with burnout and patients are coming in sicker. The virus's Omicron variant spread so widely that the state's modeling team believes that by the end of this month, the vast majority of Coloradans will have some immunity because they have been vaccinated, survived an infection, or both. It's not clear what will happen as that immunity fades or if new variants develop, but it should keep hospitalizations relatively low for a few months. While a reprieve from COVID-19 is welcome, it doesn't mean everything is back to the way it was before the pandemic, said Dr. Anuj Mehta, a critical and pulmonary care physician at Denver Health. Hospitals need to manage a backlog of patients who didn't get non-emergency care during previous surges, some of whom may be significantly sicker than they would have been with timely treatment, and they're trying to do it with fewer nurses and providers, he said. We need to recognize this is a problem and stop the rhetoric that the emergency is over, he said. This is a 5-year problem, and it needs to be a 5 to 10 year solution. With previous waves, healthcare workers had a relative lull to recharge, but that wasn't the case this winter, said Dr. Michelle Barron, Senior Medical Director of Infection Control and Prevention at UC Health. Hospitalizations have dropped somewhat from November's peak of the wave, fueled by the Delta variant before Omicron hit, but close to 1,000 people with COVID-19 were still receiving care when admissions started rising again. At the worst point of the Omicron wave, the sixth wave Colorado has endured, confirmed COVID-19 hospitalizations peaked at 1,676. That's behind only the third wave, which peaked at 1,847 hospitalizations in December 2020. While the number of patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19 has fallen steadily since then, hospitals remain nearly full, with about 91% of general beds and 89% of intensive care beds still occupied. The number of beds available has gone down as hospitals close temporary surge spaces and sometimes struggle with staffing, said Kara Welch, spokeswoman for the Colorado Hospital Association. Hospitals weren't built or staffed to operate over about 85% of capacity for extended times, and patients tend to fare worse when their caregivers are stretched too thin, Mehta said. At Denver Health, more than 90% of beds have been full since October, which stresses the direct care staffers, he said. When you sustain that for months at a time, that has an impact, he said. Sicker patients, fewer caregivers. While the volume of patients with COVID-19 is expected to continue to fall, a surge of people dealing with delayed care is replacing it, Mehta said. Patients who didn't get colonoscopies over the past 2 years are coming in with advanced cancers, and a few people have had HIV complications that Mehta said he hadn't seen in a decade, likely because their medication regimens were disrupted. Dr. Ramnik Dhaliwal, president of the Colorado chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, said putting off non-emergency procedures helped to keep patient volume under control during surges and avoided overrunning hospitals. But now the long-term effects are becoming clearer as people come in sicker, he said. It's a really fine line in what you can do short-term that doesn't affect things long-term, he said. A nurse at a Denver area hospital who spoke to the Denver Post on condition of anonymity over concerns about retaliation said she is seeing patients with greater care needs with fewer people to care for them. While the hospital where she works has done better than many in giving employees financial incentives to stay, nurses continue leaving bedside positions because they're dealing with grief and trauma, made worse by abuse from patients and their families. I'm not sure how that gets fixed, she said. It's a feeling she understands. The nurse worked in critical care before the pandemic and for most of the past 2 years. Before COVID-19, she was used to losing one or two patients in a month. But after seeing so many deaths for months on end, she needed a break and switched to a unit where most patients recover quickly. During COVID, I sometimes had three of my patients die in a day, she said. It got to the point where I was just reeling. Even as a surge continues to abate in mid-February, two in every five Colorado hospitals report they expect to be short-staffed in the coming week. It isn't clear how much of the problem is caused by relatively transient factors, like employees being out sick, and how much is a result of a long-term problem. Dr. Darlene Tatey, Vice President of Clinical Affairs at the Colorado Hospital Association, estimated hospitals in Colorado and nationwide have lost about 20% to 30% of their frontline staffers since the beginning of the pandemic, either because they went to work for staffing agencies or left the industry. A small number left over vaccine mandates, but state data shows about 98.9% of Colorado hospital employees were either vaccinated or received an exemption. It will take months to years to replace those people with new graduates, so holding on to the workers that hospitals already have will be doubly important in the near future, she said. The problem is that the pipeline is pretty sparse, she said. Mehta said that he's concerned about the coming months as colleagues begin to process the trauma they've experienced over the past 2 years. Some people who stayed because they didn't want to leave their colleagues during a crisis may decide the time has come to move on, particularly if they don't get the support they need to deal with exhaustion and guilt over the times they couldn't help, he said. I think that people reached the exhaustion point months ago and continued to do their jobs, he said. Preparing for future surges. Now that it appears hospitals will get a reprieve from the virus for at least a few months, there's time to begin talking about what they learned in the past two waves, UC Health's Barron said. One of the biggest questions will be how to staff for future surges. Since, unlike masks and gloves, trained people can't be stockpiled until they're needed. Hospitals use modeling to help project how severe a flu season will be, so they can plan accordingly. In the future, they likely will have something like that for COVID-19, Barron said. They'll need to prepare for more severe variants, more contagious ones, and the possibility of a variant that vaccines and previous infections can't stop, she said. We're still going to continue to evolve, she said. Going forward, Colorado will need a nimble response to scale up resources during surges and scale them back down when the situation improves, said Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, health systems, and others are still figuring out exactly how that will work, but it's likely that the state will step back as providers take over testing and vaccinations, he said. I have every confidence we'll be ready, he said. The level of difficulty keeping hospitals staffed was higher in this wave, although other sectors had the same problem as so many people got infected, Bookman said. But the state-run Healthcare Staffing Center and the Center for Coordinating Transfers Between Hospitals helped, as did state efforts to make testing widely available, he said. We went into the winter prepared for this, he said. While the Omicron variant was different from previous versions of the virus, hospitalizations shot up faster, but also fell faster. Facilities used essentially the same playbook for opening surge beds and staffing up, Tate said. It's likely they will be able to do the same with future waves, although how many beds and workers are needed will depend on the situation, she said. While there's no doubt healthcare workers will step up if there's another surge, they need support to keep going, Tate said. 2 years of a pandemic has left many people feeling battered, and when the public takes out their frustration on their nurses, it makes the situation worse, she said. I am very worried about that, she said. Not ever going back to before. Even if COVID-19 doesn't produce large surges in the future, the problems facing the healthcare system aren't going away overnight. Dhaliwal, the president of the Emergency Physicians Group, said one of the first steps to fixing the problem is finding out exactly how big the gap between workforce needs and the number of trained and available people actually is. Once the state has an answer, it can work with universities, hospitals, and others to create incentives for Coloradans to go into the healthcare field and stay in state, he said. None of this is a short-term fix, he said. The public can help by trying to avoid getting the virus, since a relatively small increase in patients can tip hospitals from busy to overwhelmed, said Mehta. They can also help by getting back in touch with their primary care providers to catch up on routine care, using emergency rooms if they think their conditions are life-threatening, but not for less urgent problems, and supporting the healthcare workers in their lives, he said. Everyone's going back to their normal lives, and we're still fighting a war, he said. Barron also used the metaphor of surviving a war to describe the effect on frontline caregivers. While some people will be inspired to go into the infectious disease field, others will struggle to cope with their inability to save patients. They'll need support from their hospitals and the public. We are not ever going back to before, she said. We are changed. COVID-19. More rules fall as CDC hinting at better times, by Sarah Burnett, The Associated Press. The nation's leading health officials said Wednesday that the U.S. is moving closer to the point that COVID-19 is no longer a constant crisis, as more cities, businesses, and sports venues began lifting pandemic restrictions around the country. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said during a White House briefing that the government is contemplating a change to its mask guidance in the coming weeks, noting recent declines in COVID-19 cases, hospital admissions, and deaths. She acknowledged people are so eager for health officials to ease masking rules and other measures designed to stop the spread of the coronavirus. We all share the same goal, to get to a point where COVID-19 is no longer disrupting our daily lives, a time when it won't be a constant crisis, rather something we can prevent, protect against, and treat, Walensky said. With the Omicron variant waning and Americans eager to move beyond the virus, government and business leaders have been ahead of the CDC in ending virus measures in the past week, including ordering workers back to offices, eliminating mask mandates, and no longer requiring proof of vaccine to get into restaurants, bars, and sports and entertainment arenas. The efforts have been gaining more steam each day. Philadelphia officials on Wednesday said the city's vaccine mandate for restaurants was immediately lifted, although indoor mask mandates remain in place for now. At Disney World, vaccinated guests will no longer have to wear masks at the Florida theme park starting Thursday. Professional sports teams, including the Utah Jazz, Washington Wizards, and Washington Capitals, have stopped requiring proof of vaccine for fans. Health Commissioner Cheryl Bedegole said Philadelphia's average daily case count had dropped to 189 cases per day in the city of more than 1.5 million people. Bedegole said the plunge in infections has been steeper in Philadelphia than elsewhere in the state or the country, making it easier to lift the vaccine mandate for restaurants and other businesses announced in mid-December, and that just fully went into effect this month. Our goal has always been to the least restrictive as possible when ensuring safety, she said. In Provincetown, Massachusetts, a seaside town that became a COVID hotspot with an early outbreak of the Delta variant last summer, officials on Tuesday lifted a mask mandate and vaccine requirement for indoor spaces like restaurants and bars. Town manager Alex Morse said the community of about 3,000 recorded zero active cases last week among Provincetown residents, something that hasn't happened since the surge after last year's July 4th celebrations. We are learning to live with and mitigate the impact of the virus in our community, Morse said. Biden is hoping to use his upcoming State of the Union address to nudge the pandemic into the nation's rearview mirror, but it could turn into yet another disruptive display of national tensions and frustration over trying to move past COVID-19. Biden's March 1st address to Congress will play out against what Vice President Kamala Harris has called a malaise over the persistence of COVID-19 and growing public impatience to get back to normal after 2 years of pandemic restrictions. The setting, Capitol Hill, remains one of the most significantly disrupted workplaces in the country, something of a ground zero for culture wars over the lingering restrictions. Proxy voting in the House allows lawmakers to skip going into the office and has been extended through March. Tours and office visits are limited. GOP lawmakers have racked up thousands of dollars in fines for violating mask-wearing mandates on the House floor. COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations have fallen sharply in the U.S., with the 7-day rolling average for daily new cases dropping from about 453,000 2 weeks ago to about 136,000 as of Tuesday, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Hospitalizations are at levels similar to September, when the U.S. was emerging from the Delta variant surge. About 65% of Americans are fully vaccinated. As a result of all this progress and the tools we now have, we are moving to a time where COVID isn't a crisis, but is something we can protect against and treat, said Jeff Zients, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator. Walensky said the CDC will soon put guidance in place that is relevant and encourages prevention measures when they are most needed to protect public health and our hospitals. She suggested any changes will take into account measures of community transmission, as well as hospitalization rates or other gauges of whether infected people are becoming severely ill. They will also consider available bed space in hospital. Several states with indoor mask mandates announced last week they would be lifted in coming weeks, also citing promising numbers. Two music festivals that draw thousands of people to the California desert town of Indio in April and May, Coachella and Stagecoach, also said this week there will be no vaccination, masking, or testing mandates in accordance with local guidelines. Coachella also noted that could change along with COVID-19 conditions. In Philadelphia, Bedegole said the vaccine mandate helped spur a very large increase in pediatric vaccinations, pushing the city way ahead of the national average for first doses among kids ages 5 to 11. More than 53% of Philadelphia residents in that age group have received a first dose, compared to closer to 30% nationally, she said. Not all businesses plan to immediately change course. Philadelphia Irish sports bar and restaurant O'Neill's will keep asking to see customers' vaccination cards for now, said managing partner Greg Spoony Rand, even though the city is lifting its vaccine mandate. Guests are more compliant and employees are more happy for us to continue doing vaccine cards inside, he said. He thinks vaccinated people will be wary of coming in if the pub stops checking cards. Walensky said the CDC wants to give people a break from things like mask wearing when circumstances improve, but be able to mask up again if things worsen. High Gas Costs from Ukraine Threat Pose a Political Risk by Josh Bowick, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. With the continuing threat of Russia invading Ukraine, a foreign policy crisis is colliding with one of President Joe Biden's political vulnerabilities, rising gasoline prices at home. Americans already are dismayed by inflation at a 40-year high, and Biden is warning that gas prices could get higher if Russian President Vladimir Putin chooses to invade. It's a recognition of Biden's own risks before the 2022 midterm elections. Inflation has become an albatross for Democrats despite the nation's strong economic growth last year. We're prepared to deploy all the tools and authority at our disposal to provide relief at the gas pump, the U.S. president declared Tuesday. We are taking active steps to alleviate the pressure on our own energy markets and offset rising prices. The cost of crude oil and gasoline began to climb over the past month as Putin massed forces on the Ukrainian border. Tensions over Ukraine abruptly ratcheted up Wednesday as Western officials accused Russia of lying about whether it had really begun pulling back troops from the Ukrainian border. After days marked by flickers of hope that the conflict might be resolved peacefully, a senior U.S. official told reporters that far from winding down its deployment, Moscow had added more than 7,000 combatants. Western allies expressed similar doubts about the Russian claims. The U.S. official directly accused Russia of lying, saying there was fresh evidence it was mobilizing for war. British military officials said Wednesday they had spotted Russian armored vehicles, helicopters, and a field hospital moving toward Ukraine's border. Contrary to their claims, Russia continues to build up military capabilities near Ukraine. Lieutenant General Jim Hockenhull, the British Chief of Defense Intelligence, said in a statement, Russia has a military mass in place to conduct an invasion of Ukraine. The diplomatic back and forth has whiplashed financial and commodity markets as investors try to price in what an armed conflict and U.S. sanctions against Russia would mean for the global economy. Even though the broad U.S. economy can absorb higher energy prices, American families have been seeing sharp increases in the price of food, energy, and other goods. Forecasts from J.P. Morgan and other investment firms suggest that crude oil, already at about $95 a barrel, could exceed $125 a barrel because of tight supplies, which an invasion would intensify. Biden wants to put the focus on how the Ukraine situation is contributing to higher gasoline prices, but costs at the pump were dramatically higher from a year ago. Efforts to coax more oil production in the U.S. and abroad largely have failed. Republicans most certainly won't give Biden a pass or attentions abroad. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell criticizes the president for higher energy and food prices, contending that the Biden administration seems less interested in trying to solve this problem than in trying to persuade families the pain is just in their heads. In a December AP NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll, most Americans, 85%, said they had experienced higher than usual prices for both groceries and gas in recent months. And in an open-ended question about top issues for the government to be working on, 10% named gas prices and energy costs, a sign of the political challenge confronting Biden. Given the world that we're in, any increase in prices of commodities, even if that is transitory, even if the Federal Reserve generally tries to look past obvious supply shocks in making its decisions, it adds to the policy conundrum, said Gerard DePippo, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It puts the White House in a bind. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Wednesday that National Security Council Middle East Coordinator Brett McGurk and the State Department's Energy Envoy Amos Hochstein were in Riyadh on Wednesday to meet with Saudi officials. She would not comment on whether they were pressing the Saudis to pump more oil to help stabilize the global oil market. Biden did not spell out Tuesday what additional steps his administration would take to reduce oil prices should the situation in Ukraine worsen. In late November, he ordered the release of a record 50 million barrels of oil from the U.S. Strategic Reserve to reduce price pressures. Gasoline prices did fall in the weeks after the oil was released, though prices have since eclipsed the levels at the time when Biden announced this drawdown. He could order another release if diplomacy fails to cause the Russians to pull back. Members of Congress are looking for other ways to ease the pain. Democratic Senators Mark Kelly of Arizona and Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, both up for re-election, are calling for a suspension of the federal gasoline tax. The White House has yet to endorse or rule out this option. What people are focusing on is what we can do immediately, said Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat. People need relief right now. So this is a short-term way to do it. Gas prices are up nearly 40% from a year ago and more than 6% over the past month, according to AAA. Suspending the federal tax of 18.4 cents a gallon would not offset the price increases that occurred recently as Russia threatened Ukraine. And there is no guarantee that energy companies would pass all of the savings on to consumers. It is also unclear whether there is enough support in the Senate for a gas tax holiday to go forward. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska equated it to a one-off sugar high that could wear off quickly. I don't think that's the solution here, Murkowski said. This doesn't solve the problem for people paying high prices at the pump. This is a, we're going to stop you from thinking about it by giving you a little bit of an offset here. Douglas County District will not release names. Requests made for IDs of teachers, staffers who protested policies, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Douglas County School District will not release the names of teachers and staff members who called out sick this month in protest of recent decisions by the school board, despite a request filed by someone for the information under the state's open records law. Who requested the list of names or why is unknown. Teachers who were absent February 3rd received an email from the district that only said an individual sought a list of names of employees who were out that day. Information that is considered a public record under the Colorado Open Records Act, according to a copy of the email reviewed by the Denver Post. The person who sought the information rescinded their public records request, said board member David Ray. There may have been many different reasons teachers were absent that day, and many did so only after DCSD moved to a non-student contact day, said board president Mike Peterson. At this time, the district will not be releasing the names. Peterson made the announcement after the board spent more than an hour in closed session. Members discuss legal and safety issues related to the open records request. The request sparked fears among teachers and others in the district that the list of names will be used to intimidate and target employees, according to a teacher and one school board member. It definitely puts out there that we are waging a war on teachers, said Paula Dutenhofer, a teacher in the district who attended the protests. To me, it feels like they're giving us a very clear message that teachers do not have a voice. The public records request asks for a database or list of the names of Douglas County School District teachers and staff who submitted absence requests for February 3rd, 2022. It does not differentiate between employees who called out to join the rally or for any other reason, such as being sick, according to the email reviewed by the Post. Similar requests have been made before. For example, a parent in Golden requested the names of teachers who called out sick from high schools in Jefferson County to protest school board policies in 2014. The Jefferson County Education Association sued to stop the release, but courts ruled that the records are not part of a teacher's confidential personnel file, a court reported Chalkbeat, Colorado. Tensions are also running high after flyers were found on six vehicles at Legend High School and Iron Horse Elementary in Parker that said teachers' unions aren't good for children and parents. Most teachers are good and we appreciate them. You are bad. Get out and leave, the flyers read. Douglas County parents, grandparents, and taxpayers own the schools. Remember that. We approve the curriculum, not you, not the teachers' unions. District security and our law enforcement partners are looking into this, Hans said. This is no way to move forward as a district, Peterson said about the flyers. Our teachers should be respected and supported for the work they do for our students every day. All of this comes on the heels of the recent firing of Superintendent Corey Wise. Wise was fired in a February 4th meeting that spotlighted the divide among board members and the broader community. Meanwhile, hundreds of teachers and other staff members had called out sick the day before to support Wise and to demand transparency of the board. The protest took place after the board voted for a review of the equity policy and allegations by three minority members that other members had issued an ultimatum to Wise to resign or being voted out. The district canceled classes the day of the protest because there were so many requests for substitutes, and it was followed by a walkout by hundreds of students 4 days later. After the rally by the teachers, former district attorney George Brockler had called for the release of the names of employees who participated so that parents can ask them and confront them, he said in an interview Tuesday. Brockler, who is a freelance columnist for The Post, denied filing the public records request seeking teachers' names, saying that the request is just asking for teachers' names and not other information, such as addresses or email information, that could put them at risk. I've made no efforts to get that information other than referencing it on the radio, he said. Before the school board meeting, member Susan Meeks said she hoped the board would address the issue of the public records request during Wednesday night's meeting, saying, "Teachers are not feeling safe. People assume if your name was on this list, you were at a protest." Firestone, drilling plan put on hold, by Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. A proposal for 33 oil and gas wells near a neighborhood in Firestone is on hold while the company revises its plan to add more safeguards and review alternative locations as requested by state regulators. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission voted Wednesday to put off a decision on the proposal by Keir McGee until March 10th. The proposal by the subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum is seen as a test of Senate Bill 181, a 2019 law that revamped state regulations to prioritize public health, safety, and the environment when regulating oil and gas. One of the new rules requires wells to be at least 2,000 feet from homes and schools, but allows exceptions. The exception at the heart of debate over Keir McGee's proposal allows wells to be drilled closer if a company's plan would provide protections substantially equivalent to drilling farther away. The COGCC staff determined that the proposal complies with the rule. The five-member Oil and Gas Commission will decide whether to approve the application. However, opponents of Keir McGee's proposal said the two well pads don't belong in an area that includes several homes, as well as trails and a golf course. Personally, I do not want this facility within 2,000 feet of my patio and backyard. It places me and my family at unnecessary and unavoidable risk, exactly what the commission's regulations seek to prevent, said William McGahey, who has lived in the nearby subdivision for about a year. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment said in a letter to the COGCC that it should deny the application unless Keir McGee agrees to 13 steps to minimize the potential health and environmental impacts of the wells. The company agreed during Wednesday's hearing to look at adopting more of the department's recommendations, including using electric drilling rigs and drilling muds with safer materials. As with our hearings before the town of Firestone, we are listening to the comments and considering all feedback to be the best neighbor possible in the communities we operate. We respect the commission's decision to continue our application to March 10th, Occidental spokeswoman Jennifer Bryce said in an email. The Firestone Board of Trustees approved the locations of the two well pads in January. The 3,600-acre McGavin well pad would have 26 wells within 2,000 feet of 87 homes, the closest one 763 feet away. The 640-acre Columbine pad, southeast of the bigger pad, would have 7 wells and be within 2,000 feet of 7 homes. Frank Jimenez, Firestone Mayor Pro Tem, said Keir McGee has always been willing to work with residents, listen to them, and accommodate their concerns as much as possible. We have a history in Firestone of working in a cooperative way to achieve some balance and some peaceful coexistence between energy development and quality of life in a growing community. I really think this application serves as a good example of that, said A.J. Krieger, town manager. Under an agreement between the town and Kerr McGee, the company will give Firestone a 78-acre tract of undeveloped land. Krieger said there is no link between the agreement and the town's approval of the location of the well pads. Kerr McGee has said it reviewed other locations, but those would be within 2,000 feet of even more homes or require more pads to access the oil and gas. Jeffco Public Health, unnamed team to lead until new director found, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. The Jefferson County Board of Health announced Wednesday it has appointed a team to lead the department for now, but didn't specify who will be in charge until a new director is hired. The previous executive director, Dr. Don Comstock, resigned February 7th. The Board of Health received her resignation during an executive session, and members haven't commented publicly on what led up to it, other than to thank Comstock for her service. A news release announcing the interim senior leadership team didn't specify who would be part of the team, saying only that it included many longtime leaders and directors of Jefferson County Public Health. It did say that Dr. Sarah Rowan, the local health department's medical director, will continue in her position. State law requires health departments to have a medical director on staff or someone fulfilling that role as a consultant. The board is still in the planning stages of recruiting a new executive director, according to the news release. Board of Health President Sherry John thanked the interim team for leading the department while they go through the hiring process. The interim senior leadership team has already stepped up to the plate in leading JCPH through a difficult transition period following two extremely demanding years, she said in a news release. We look forward to keeping the public updated through this transition with the interim senior leadership team and the coming search for the next executive director of JCPH. RMNP closing areas used by nesting raptors, from the Reporter Herald. Rocky Mountain National Park officials launched temporary closures Tuesday to protect nesting raptors. Areas of the park are closed each year during nesting season to let the birds of prey nest undisturbed, according to a news release from the park. Because of high nesting activity in 2020-21, closures began February 15th rather than March 1st, and they will continue through July 31st if needed. Closures could be extended or rescinded at an earlier date, depending on nesting activity, the release stated. One closure is in place in the Loch Vale area, including Cathedral Wall. The areas above the Loch Vale Sky Pond Trail are closed to off-trail travel. In the Lumpy Ridge area, closures include Checkerboard Rock, Lightning Rock, Batman Pinnacle, Sundance, Thunder Buttress, The Parish, Bookmark Pinnacle, The Left Book, Bookmark, Twin Owls, Rock One, and The Needle. Closures include all climbing routes, outcroppings, cliffs, faces, ascent and descent routes, and climber access trails to the named rock formations. Check the park's website at nps.gov/romo/raptor-closures.htm for maps and updated information on raptor closures. CU will keep mask order for indoor spaces. Byline, Boulder. The University of Colorado on Tuesday announced it will continue requiring masks for indoor spaces on its campuses. The update comes after the Boulder County Board of Health voted to end the indoor mask mandate starting Friday. CU will continue to consult with Boulder County Public Health and its campus scientific advisory team, according to a news release from the university. It will consider making masking while indoors optional if there is continued progress in two main metrics: fulfillment of the university's COVID-19 vaccine booster requirement and continued reduction of community transmission in Boulder County, the release said. CU is maintaining its mask requirement for the time being to ensure it safeguards the in-person experience by not letting its guard down too soon, the the release said. This article was from the Daily Camera. January 6th Capitol breach. Biden orders release of Trump White House logs by Colleen Long, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden is ordering the release of Trump White House visitor logs to the House committee investigating the riot of January 6, 2021, once more rejecting former President Donald Trump's claims of executive privilege. The committee has sought a trove of data from the National Archives, including presidential records that Trump had fought to keep private. The records being released to Congress are visitor logs showing appointment information for individuals who were allowed to enter the White House on the day of the insurrection. In a letter sent Monday to the National Archives, White House counsel Dana Remus said Biden had considered Trump's claim that because he was president at the time of the attack on the U.S. Capitol, the records should remain private, but she decided it was not in the best interest of the United States to do so. She also noted that as a matter of policy, the Biden administration voluntarily discloses such visitor logs on a monthly basis, as did the Obama administration, and that the majority of the entries over which Trump asserted the claim would be publicly released under the current policy. A Trump spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the decision. The Presidential Records Act mandates that records made by a sitting president and his staff be preserved in the National Archives, and an outgoing president is responsible for turning over documents to the agency when leaving office. Trump tried but failed to withhold White House documents from the House committee in a dispute that was decided by the Supreme Court. Biden has made clear he is not invoking executive privilege concerning the congressional investigation unless he absolutely must. Biden has waived that privilege for much other information requested by the committee, which is going through the material and obtaining documents and testimony from witnesses, including some uncooperative ones. The committee is focused on Trump's actions from January 6th, when he waited hours to tell his supporters to stop the violence and leave the Capitol. Investigators are also interested in the organization and financing of a Washington rally the morning of the riot, when Trump told supporters to fight like hell. Among the unanswered questions is how close organizers of the rally coordinated with White House officials. Investigators are also seeking communications between the National Archives and Trump's aides about 15 boxes of records that the agency removed from Trump at his Florida resort and are trying to learn what they contained. Meanwhile, White House call logs obtained so far by the House committee do not list calls made by Trump as he watched the violence unfold on television on January 6, nor do they list calls made directly to the president. That lack of information about Trump's personal calls is a particular challenge as the investigators work to discern what the then president was doing in the White House as supporters violently beat police, broke into the Capitol, and interrupted the congressional certification of Democrat Biden's election victory. There are several explanations for omissions in the records, which do not reflect conversations that Trump had January 6th with multiple Republican lawmakers, for example. Trump was known to use a personal cell phone, or he could have had a phone passed to him by an aide. The committee is continuing to receive records from the National Archives and other sources, which could produce additional information. Former Interior Secretary, Investigation, Zinke Misused His Position, by Matthew Brown, The Associated Press, Byline, Billings, Montana. Former U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke misused his position to advance a commercial development project that included a microbrewery in his Montana hometown and lied to an agency ethics official about his involvement in the project, according to a report by federal investigators released Wednesday. The investigation by the Interior Department's Inspector General found that Zinke continued working on the commercial project through a nonprofit foundation in the resort community of Whitefish, Montana, even after he committed upon taking office to break ties with the foundation. The report also said Zinke gave incorrect and incomplete information to an Interior Department ethics official who confronted him over his involvement, and that Zinke ordered Interior Department staffers to help him with the project in a misuse of his position. The Great Northern Veterans Peace Park Foundation was created by Zinke and others in 2007 to build a community sledding hill in Whitefish, a tourist town about 25 miles from Glacier National Park and near the Montana-Canada border. The BNSF Railway Company donated several acres of land to the foundation in 2008 to establish the park. After being named Interior Secretary in 2017, Zinke agreed to cut ties with the foundation and to stop providing it with his services. But after resigning as the foundation's president and while he was employed as the Interior Secretary, Zinke engaged in repeated ongoing substantive negotiations with developers about the use of foundation property for a commercial project known as 95 Caro. Investigators said the project included a potential microbrewery. Zinke is a candidate in the June Republican primary for an open Montana congressional seat, a position he held prior to joining former President Donald Trump's cabinet. Democrats ask Biden to review treatment of black migrants by Aline Sullivan, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. More than 100 Democratic members of Congress pressed President Joe Biden on Wednesday to address disparate and often inhumane treatment of black migrants by the immigration enforcement system, reviving concerns over the mass deportations last fall of asylum-seeking Haitians despite the ongoing crisis in their country. In a letter to the president, the lawmakers, including Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, asked Biden to order a review of law enforcement and court records to assess how black migrants are treated compared with other migrants at the border, in detention, and in the immigration court system. In addition to stopping removals to regions such as Haiti that face serious insecurity, we also urge you to take steps to address the systemic challenges black migrants face to receiving equal treatment, the lawmakers wrote. It is essential that we recommit ourselves to reversing anti-black policies, including by adopting a human rights-centered approach to supporting immigrants and people seeking asylum in the United States. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent of Vermont, joined 13 Democratic senators and 88 Democratic House members in signing the letter, which was initiated by Representative Cori Bush of Missouri and Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. The concerns expressed in it are among a growing list that liberals have regarding the administration's progress on issues important to the Democratic Party's base, which also include climate change, voting rights, and student loan debt. The letter is the second this week from members of the president's party pressuring the Biden administration to stop using a Trump-era public health rule to turn away migrants at the southwest border during the pandemic. Next month, it will mark 2 years since that policy, Title 42, was put in place. Immigration and human rights advocates say it is the greatest impediment to asylum seekers. Border officials have used the public health rule to turn away migrants more than 2 million times since it went into effect. The administration allowed more than 8,900 Haitians into the country from September to December to appear in immigration court and request asylum. But during that period, it used the public health rule to expel about the same number, according to government data. In news briefs, Kushner ally pardoned by Trump takes plea deal, Byline, New York. Ken Kherson, a former editor of the New York Observer who was charged with unlawfully spying on his former wife, pleaded guilty Wednesday to two misdemeanors with the opportunity to have the charges further reduced after a year. Kherson, 53, had been charged in August by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office with eavesdropping and computer trespass, both felonies, each of which carry a penalty of up to 4 years in prison. On Wednesday, he pleaded guilty to attempting both crimes, but under the terms of his plea deal, if he completes 100 hours of community service and is not arrested in connection with another crime, he will withdraw those pleas and plead to the lesser offense of second-degree harassment, a violation, in a year. U.S. warns Americans abroad not to count on a rescue. Byline, Washington. As U.S. officials grew concerned this month that Russia might invade Ukraine, they implored U.S. citizens to leave the country immediately and added a grim addendum. No rescuers would be coming for those who stayed behind, they said. It was a point President Joe Biden drove home last week by insisting that he would not use the military to extract anyone trapped by a Russian attack. All Americans should leave Ukraine, he told NBC News, adding that he could not risk a clash with Russian troops that might trigger World War III. The fallout from the summer's chaotic evacuation of Americans from Afghanistan appears to have shaped Biden's approach to the Ukraine crisis in multiple ways, from more explicit coordination with European allies, who in some cases felt sidelined from Afghanistan planning, to greater transparency about the most dire intelligence assessments. EU can withhold funds from Hungary and Poland, top court rules. Byline, Brussels. In a ruling hailed as a boost to democratic values, the European Union's highest court said Wednesday that the 27-nation bloc can suspend support payments to member states if they breach rule of law principles. The right-wing governments of Hungary and Poland, which had challenged the EU's right to take such action, responded by arguing that the rule lacked a proper legal basis and would fundamentally interfere with their running of national business. Both nations, large recipients of EU funds, have come under increasing criticism in the past few years for veering away from democratic norms with policies such as exerting excessive control over the judiciary, stifling media freedom, and denying the rights of LGBT people. When it comes to democratic principles, the European Union must be able to defend those values within the limits of its powers, the European Court of Justice said. The court decision was the last legal impediment to EU institutions withholding funds from any government they consider to be at odds with core democratic principles. The rule, seen as the EU's most potent weapon to prevent a democratic rift from deepening within the bloc, was approved 14 months ago. FBI says defendants in Arbery killing used racial slurs repeatedly. Byline, Brunswick, Georgia. Two of the three white men convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery repeatedly used racial slurs in text messages and social media posts, including some violent comments by Arbery's shooter about black people, an FBI witness testified Wednesday in their federal hate crimes trial. FBI intelligence analyst Amy Vaughn led the jury through more than two dozen conversations that Travis McMichael and William Roddy Bryan had with others, identified only by their initials, in the months and years before the 25-year-old black man's killing. The FBI wasn't able to access the phone of Greg McMichael, Travis McMichael's father, because it was encrypted, Vaughn said. In text and Facebook conversations with friends, Travis McMichael frequently used the N-word to describe black people. In a Facebook conversation with a friend, he also shared a video of a young black boy dancing on a TV show with a racist song that included the N-word playing over it. He also said black people ruin everything and said more than once he was glad he wasn't a black person, using a racial slur. These briefs were from Denver Post Wire Services. U.S. accuses China of backing away from its free trade commitments, by Paul Weissman, the Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The United States has accused China of failing to meet its commitments to the World Trade Organization and says it is exploring new ways to combat aggressive Chinese trade practices. In its annual report on Chinese compliance with WTO rules, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative said Wednesday that China isn't keeping the promises it made to open its markets to foreign competition when it joined the 164-country Geneva-based agency in 2001. China has instead retained and expanded its state-led non-market approach to the economy and trade, said U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai. China's policies and practices challenge the premise of the WTO's rules and cause serious harm to workers and businesses around the world. Among other things, the United States repeated longstanding accusations that China uses subsidies and regulations to favor its own companies at the expense of foreign competitors, floods world markets with cheap steel, aluminum, and other products, and forces U.S. and other foreign companies to hand over prized technology as the price of access to Chinese markets. The U.S. report said, China's leadership appears confident in its state-led, non-market approach to the economy and trade and feels no need to conform to global norms. The U.S. Trade Office said it is continuing to talk to China about obtaining real change in its economic and trade regime, and it is working with allies and through the WTO to put pressure on the Chinese government. Without offering specifics, the report said the U.S. is also exploring new ways to use domestic trade tools strategically as needed in order to achieve a more level playing field with China for U.S. workers and businesses. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.